his very best. We saw in Shanghai those reflexes that are incredible, like a mongoose on amphetamine.
Murray wins it all. He's champion of the Barclays ATP World Tour Finals.
Has done it. Joe Konta. It is confirmed. Joe Konta with the biggest title of her career at the Miami Open and now also at a new career high.
You can't be serious, man. You cannot be serious. That ball was on the line. Shock flew up.
This is URN Sport.
Hello and welcome to the second instalment of URN's very new tennis podcast, Strawberries and Cream. I'm your host, Ollie Roberts, taking the place of Matt Webb this week. He wants to give some of his opinions in the tennis world as a pundit this time round. I'm also joined by Rahul. Unfortunately for all of you listening, we have a whole host of topics to discuss today. But it's been a while since our last episode, lads, hasn't it? And if you weren't already aware of our dedication to this podcast, we've just spent about an hour trying to turn on a computer. So
we're more than expertise here at URN.
Yeah, so we're more than ready to get underway now. And what better place to start than the upcoming French Open? So I think the thing to discuss really is, who is the form player in the world right now? Who do we think is going to win this? I think I know who all of you are going to say. Do I even need to say it?
I think the man you're still talking about is Rafael Nadal. He is quite simply the best clay player of all time. I think there's no disputing that. I believe the man's won 11 French Opens. He's just sealed his 11th Monte Carlo Masters victory on the clay court, staying world number one. And the thing is, he's not even looked troubled. He's dominated some really class players. Kei Nishikori had a fantastic tournament, and he took him apart in the final. Nadal on clay is unbeatable at the moment, and I think I would be very surprised if anybody beats him at the French Open, let alone in the clay season, full stop.
Yeah, well, you've pretty much answered my next question there, Matt. As you said, Nadal won the Monte Carlo Masters in straight sets versus Kei Nishikori, and listen to this for a statistic, he's won 38 straight sets on the clay surface. So, Rahul, can anyone stop him at Roland Garros?
I mean, you'd bet your house on Nadal definitely winning the French Open. But I'm just going to put a caveat in there. I'm gonna propose that Del Potro could potentially go quite far in this tournament. I mean, he recently won the Indian Wells against Federer, as everyone knows. And, you know, his previous three tournaments in the French Open, he lost against big players. Like, in 2009, he reached the semifinals. And then in 2011, he lost against Djokovic, I believe. In 2012, Federer, and recently in 2017, he lost against Murray. So he has got quite far in these tournaments and has lost against big-name players. And especially with his form recently, and especially with him being able to monitor and control his injuries, he is someone that definitely could pose a threat to Nadal. But obviously, as everyone is assuming, Nadal is definitely going to walk through this tournament.
I think Rahul makes a very good point about Del Potro. He really is a form player at the moment. He had a great season on the American hard court, and he's starting to show promise of the man he once was. Obviously, he was in the US Open in 2009 against Federer. And he's got the weapons to do it. He's got a huge serve, huge forehand, really exciting player to watch. I think it's really good for tennis to have players like Del Potro getting to the top of the game, playing a really exciting brand of tennis that is really refreshing to watch. And I think that is a very good call from Rahul to look at him potentially going all the way in the French. It just depends on what draw he gets, really. I think if he gets a favourable draw, we could see a Del Potro Nadal final, and we would not be surprised by that.
Yeah, I think we're all in unanimous agreement that Del Potro probably poses one of the main threats to Nadal. And like you both said, it's very, very pleasing to see him back like this. I think everybody's recognised his potential from a young age, but unfortunately, he's been plagued by injuries, and that's probably stopped him with competing with the likes of the Big Four and maybe Stanislas Wawrinka in the last couple of years. So a few statistics for you on Del Potro. He's got 15 wins in his last 16 games, two tournament wins, including victory over Roger Federer, and his sole loss recently was against John Isner in the semi-final of the Miami Open. The question that I'm going to pose to you, though, is can he do it on clay? These victories have obviously come on his preferred hard court surface. He has reached the semi-final of Roland Garros in 2009, but at the same time, he has only passed the third round twice.
This shows that he does have the potential to do it, but it's also, I think you make a very good point. Del Potro's favourite surface is undoubtedly the hard court. And whilst he's had some success in on the clay, as Rahul mentioned, with reaching the semi-final of the French in 2009, when he was at the peak of his abilities, he's not been able to always be as successful, and he's won most of his tournaments on the hard court. That does play against him. And I think that Nadal's expertise on the clay and the amount of experience he's purely got just playing on it so much, I think really does help him and give him the edge in this potential encounter.
I think even the way Del Potro plays in terms of his hard shots and serves, it doesn't really suit the clay court as much as it does with the hard court. I think that definitely does play against the fact that Del Potro isn't going to be assumed to win the game. But I mean, Nadal's belief and his previous experience definitely just puts him one level above everyone else, and that will surely like ensure that he wins all the games that he plays.
Yeah, I'd probably concur with what both of you are saying, in the sense that even though Del Potro is obviously in the form of his career, that doesn't necessarily mean he's going to win the French Open. This isn't his surface. If he's still in this sort of vein of form come Wimbledon, come the US Open, then by all means I think he's got every chance of winning both those tournaments. But at the minute, I think Nadal's going to be too strong for him on clay. One player which is very interesting though that we didn't mention as probably the most likely person to beat Nadal at Roland Garros is Novak Djokovic, a man who's been back for a few weeks now. He made his return from injury a couple of months ago now. He lost to Martin Kližan recently, and he's not reached the quarterfinal in any of the five events he's played since injury. What's happened?
I think that it's one of those, it's very difficult coming back from injury as a tennis player, because to get the right rhythm and power and to be able to at the top of the game again is so difficult, because there are such fine margins in a sport like tennis. I think Djokovic has struggled. I think the mentality has also been difficult for him. You know, I think the match he won in the Monte Carlo Masters was something like his first win in a month or two. So that's just, it's really surprising when you consider a player of Djokovic's calibre that they should go that long without winning a match. It's really, really shocking, to be honest. But I think that, you know, it's I would expect him to put in a better show at the French Open. I think he gets really pumped up for the big occasion. And also the French Open is a special tournament for him, the last place where he won a Grand Slam to complete the career sweep. So I think it is something that he'll be really up for doing well in. Although it's interesting, he separated from his coach Andre Agassi, has actually done quite well since then, so that might be a good thing for him.
But yeah, coming back from injury is definitely going to take time. We saw that with Nadal, with his chronic knee and wrist injuries. It did take him a year or two for him to regain that strength and that form, where people were calling that, is this the end of Nadal a few years ago? He has now recently like recovered that form, and it could potentially take Djokovic 1 year or a few tournaments to get into the rhythm and form.
Yeah, I think on the previous Strawberries and Cream podcast, Matt actually mentioned that he thinks there could be a chance Djokovic could retire fairly soon.
Yeah,
and
I stand by this.
Yeah, does this statement sort of prove this further for you?
I think if Djokovic doesn't win a tournament all year, then he might well retire. I think it's less likely than it was before, but I still maintain it could well happen in the next year or two, because, you know, where's the fun in playing tennis where you're not at the peak of your game? If you've been as good as Novak Djokovic has been, but between about 2011 to 2015, he was one of the best players the world has ever seen with that form he was in. You know, he won three majors twice in a year, and that just shows you what a class act he is. And if you'd be at that level, why would you want to be playing when you're not as good as you used to be? The reason why Federer keeps on going on is because he's still at that level and able to win Grand Slams and major tournaments, and that's why he keeps on going on, I think.
If he retires soon, though, Matt, do you think he can be put in the same bracket as Nadal and Federer? I think no one's disputing that Nadal and Federer, two of the greatest players of all time. You might argue that, I don't know, a Pete Sampras or someone was maybe the best of all time, but those two are certainly up there. If Djokovic retires now, yes, he's got 12 Grand Slams, but can you put him in the same bracket?
I think so. I think the way he's won them, the fact that he's beaten Nadal, Federer, Murray to win his Grand Slams has shown that. I think, look at Andy Murray, he's been very unlucky, but he's a really, really good player. And if he, I personally think if he'd been playing in the era that Pete Sampras and Agassi have been playing in, I think it would be Murray that would be the dominant player in that era, because I think he's that good. I think I would say that Federer is the best player of all time, very close followed by Nadal, and then Djokovic coming in third, if I was being honest. But that's probably because of my bias towards the modern era, basically, as a younger tennis fan, I think.
I mean, I completely agree. I think his Grand Slam record speaks for itself and definitely puts him up in that bracket. But I guess the consistency shown over the years by players like Nadal and Federer definitely does add to that that eliteness, I guess, in terms of who he rank as the best tennis players. And I think his short burst of form, which was very impressive, I don't think puts him in that same bracket as those players like Federer and Nadal, who year by year have been turning in these amazing performances and winning Grand Slams. So I think there is a little gap between them. But that's not to say that Djokovic, if he does retire, hasn't had an amazing season and amazing record.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I think, like Matt touched upon, 12 Grand Slams in this era is pretty extraordinary. And when you consider that the vast majority of those Grand Slam wins came against Nadal, Federer and Murray in the final, I think Murray's got a pretty horrific record against Djokovic, doesn't he? I think that Wimbledon win was pretty much his only win against Djokovic at a major, I think.
He beat him in the US Open final in 2012. Of course. Murray has beaten Djokovic in two major finals, to be fair to him. But I think it is difficult for the likes of Murray to compete against Djokovic. But I think at that time, Djokovic was that player who really was at his best constantly, but really played his best on the big occasion and was able to pull his very best tennis out of the bag when it really mattered. And I think he was renowned for having such a tough mindset. And I think that mindset is one of the things that makes him such a great tennis player in this modern era.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with that, Matt. But I think with Djokovic obviously out of form at the minute, it's time for a few of these, and of course with Murray injured as well, and we'll come on to that later in the podcast. But it's time for a few of the young guns to start making a name for themselves now. And another name which I might throw into the mix for the French Open is Dominic Thiem, the world number 7. He's reached the French Open semi-final the past 2 years. What do we make of him? He has comprehensively lost to Nadal recently at Monte Carlo. But what do you make of his game? Has he got the necessary credentials to beat these top players? Or is it going to be a few years yet?
He's got a talent, there's no doubt about that. He suffered a bit of a dip. He had a really great year last year. He suffered a little bit of a dip at the beginning of this year. But I think he's definitely got the potential ability to go a long way in major finals. I don't think that he will be able to win the French Open. I do think he'll be able to have quite a good run. I would probably be a bit surprised if I didn't see him in at least be on the fourth round / quarter final, to be honest. And I think that he's definitely got a chance in the future to win a Grand Slam. You talk about a young player. The main other young player I would look at for the French Open would be Alexander Zverev. He won the Rome Masters last year, beating Djokovic in the final. So he's shown he's got pedigree on clay, and he's a very promising player. So I think he's definitely got a chance at the French.
Yeah, speaking of Thiem, I think he just hasn't reached the heights of the big top four players. I mean, he's won, I believe, 9 single ATP titles.
Yeah, I think
and
so.
He's still at the age of 24, so he's still got a few years ahead of him before he needs to start reaching the heights of the big players. But I still think in the future, potentially there is talent, as Matt, you have said, and there is potential for him breaking into that top four. But whether these players like Edmund recently, we were absolutely like elevating him as one of players to watch, and he had a big dip in form recently. So whether he's someone like that, it's gonna be seen in the next 2-3 years.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. I mean, although, as I touched upon before, he has reached the French Open semi-final on the past 2 occasions, he was relatively outclassed both times. And, as I said as well, he did lose to Nadal last week. I think he lost to Del Potro the week before as well. So yeah. These are the names that we've been touting to win the French Open. He hasn't seemingly been able to beat. So maybe it is a couple of years before Dominic Thiem makes a name for himself. Maybe we should be putting him in the same bracket as the likes of Carl Edmund, sort of youngsters who have got the talent but aren't quite there yet. But the next question I wanted to ask you is the French Open. Is it the worst Grand Slam? Is it the most boring Grand Slam? Does anyone really care about it? I mean, it's amazing seeing Nadal win it so many times. It's an absolutely incredible record he's got there. But considering if we see that he's going to take part in it, we're pretty much sure that he's going to go all the way or next to all the way. Is there anyone, do you care?
I do care about French Open, but I think that's because I'm a tennis fan. I do think if you had to pick one, it probably would be the one you care the least about, personally. I think that's for a couple of reasons. I think it's the worst. I think it's the most poorly organised. I think for one reason, they still haven't got any plans to get a roof, which is ridiculous. When you consider that every single other Grand Slam, Wimbledon's got a roof on centre court, and US Open will have a roof for the first time this year, Australia's got a roof, and Wimbledon's going to get one on court one as well. And basically, the French Open still maintain they don't have to get one. They don't have Hawkeye, because they say because it's clear you can see the mark, which has been controversial at times, and rightly so. And I think that it is, they, you know, these things are a bit bizarre, and they just need to be sort of ironed out. I think the one thing with clay as a surface is it's obviously a bit slower, so it sort of takes a bit of the bite out of the ball when you hit it. And Nadal's topspin obviously enables him to be very successful at this. I think that it can result in some really excellent rallies, but I can think it maybe does bore people a bit. I think that one thing about watching something like grass court tennis is it's so exciting because it's so fast, and you get to see such sort of fast, incisive rallies, really.
I mean, speaking personally, I've always had a soft spot for Nadal. So whichever tournament he's going to continuously win is something that I'm always going to love to watch. But I think my memories have always been from Wimbledon and the Australian Open and other court events like that. I mean, I still remember when Nadal climbed the roof in Wimbledon following his victory where he met the monarchy of the Spanish. And it's those memories which still hold on to me in comparison to like the clay court, which hasn't been as exciting as Wimbledon finals between like Federer and Nadal, and the matchups between those games.
Yeah, I suppose I can see where both of you are coming from. If you're a massive Nadal fan, I mean, obviously you're going to enjoy the French Open. From a personal perspective, though, I do see it as probably my least favourite major tournament. I will still watch it, obviously, but for me, Wimbledon is the one every year. I think being British, because of Andy Murray, yeah, like Matt said, I do think that the tennis is just faster there. You don't necessarily, like you said, you do see some long rallies at the French Open, but it just feels slower. I don't know if that's just me. I don't know if I've just got a vendetta against it, but that's just my personal opinion. But anyway, we'll put that one to rest for now, because we're probably just going to have to agree to disagree on that, sorry. But we'll move on to one person who definitely won't be challenging Nadal at the French Open, and that is Roger Federer. He announced after losing at the Miami Open to Thanasi Kokkinakis that he will be skipping the clay court season. This was Federer's second consecutive loss after a career best start to the year. What do we make of this? Was it the right decision for him, especially considering he's lost his number one spot to Nadal and probably wouldn't be favourite to win at Roland Garros anyway?
I think this is the right decision. I mean, most people would probably agree on this. We put out on our social media, follow Strawberries and Cream on Instagram. We put it out on the Instagram story and did a poll about where you thought Federer was right to miss the clay season. And 75% of people who voted said that they did think he was right to miss the clay season. I mean, it makes sense to him because he knows that he's probably not going to win a major tournament there. And he's got a much better chance of sort of saving himself for the grass court and hardcore season, which obviously is quite intense towards the end of the season, where he is, you know, one of the favourites. And he's got no points to defend from last year either, so it makes sense for him, really. At this point in his career, he's won clay tournaments before, so there's no sort of added bonus of him doing that. And at the age of, I think he's 36 now, 37, something ridiculous,
yeah,
like that.
Unbelievable.
I think he just wants to preserve his body for as long as he can by focusing on grass court and hardcore tournaments. I think Federer's thing here, I think the tournament that matters him the most is Wimbledon. I think he really wants to win Wimbledon again, and I think he can do that by missing this, so I think it does make sense for him.
Yeah, I mean, it's not really no longer a surprise now. It's his second straight year that he skipped the clay court season as a whole. And I think it's the third straight year he's missed the French Open. So it's no longer a surprise now that he is missing these clay court seasons in order to favour the hard court and the grass court seasons. But I mean, whether it's the right decision, I mean, previously he's missed the clay court season and won Wimbledon. So it does definitely help him freshen up, ensure he doesn't get fatigued, especially at his age. It definitely does help Federer, and whether we'll see other players in the next 5-10 years adopting the same strategy is something which will be interesting to look at, especially now playing involves it's so strenuous to your muscles due to the fast pace. It's definitely something which potentially in the next 5-10 years we could be seeing other tennis players adopt.
Yeah, I think it wouldn't be surprised if we see it in the future. And it could work both ways. People who favour the clay courts could stick to more clay court tournaments and perhaps give the grass season with, so we'll have to see.
Yeah, I personally think it's unbelievably clever from Federer. I think Rahul touched upon it there. Even though Federer has managed to stay in unbelievably good physical shape considering his age, playing in a tournament like Roland Garros where there's a lot of sliding around, injuries are fairly common, I think it's just such a good decision for him, because if you think about it this way, he doesn't need to be world number one. Yes, it was probably nice having that ranking, but he's been there before. I think he still holds the record for the longest amount of time ever spent at world number one. The key for him is before the end of the career, he wants to add as many Grand Slams to his already extraordinary trophy cabinet as possible. he's won a Roland Garros before. He's completed the career Grand Slam. And he probably knows that if he played Roland Garros, Rafael Nadal probably would be favourite. It's just that is a fact. He's played, I don't think he's never beaten Rafael Nadal in a French Open final, has he?
No, the one final he did win was the year that Nadal got knocked out in the fourth round by Robin Söderling. Which is obviously a huge shock at the time. So that was the only time he's actually won the French Open.
Yeah, like Matt touched upon, he has won the French Open. He has completed the career Grand Slam, and I really wouldn't be surprised to see him take this rest, use his time wisely, come back at Wimbledon, and win it again. I'd love to see it personally, especially if Murray isn't going to be where he'd like to be by then. So I definitely wouldn't be surprised to see Federer come back again, maybe even stronger than he has already been this season. But anyway, we've discussed men's tennis for a good 20 minutes now, so I think it's about time that we moved on to the women's game. So elsewhere in women's tennis, Great Britain lost 3-2 to Japan, in the Fed Cup, extending Great Britain's 25-year wait to play in the World Group. Joanna Konta won her singles game, but Heather Watson lost both her singles and her doubles game with Konta. This raises the question then, do we just give up with the Fed Cup, especially if we're going to continually suffer embarrassing defeats like these ones?
I don't think so. I think giving up is not really an option, because you've got to look that things can change, and to paraphrase a well-known song, things can only get better. It's
wow.
I mean, the thing is, if to compare it to the Davis Cup, the men's equivalent, we were really bad at that for quite a long time, and then we ended up winning it in 2015. And things can change. And I think once we get into the World Group, then it could get more publicity in this country, get more women involved in tennis, which can only be a good thing, and that will give us a greater depth of female tennis players to be able to go on and if you win the Fed Cup in the future for this country.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. Although we're not performing as well in the Fed Cup, I think the actual possibility of playing for your country is something very special, which you don't get that feeling in Wimbledon. I know there's your country name to it, and some people are playing in their home court, but playing for your country in tournament is something very special that only, like, I don't know, it's just for me, if I was a professional player, I would love to represent my country. And I think, although we're not performing as well, this is something which provides the opportunity. And as Matt, as you said, it puts it on a platform for the whole country to watch and to love. And it does definitely offer opportunities for other people to get involved in the sport.
Yeah, you two have pretty much raised the 2 points that I was going to there. I think, looking at the success the GB men's team had in the Davis Cup, they came out of nowhere, really. I think they struggled in the Davis Cup for years, and out of nowhere came away and won it. So it can happen. And I think with the likes of Joanna Konta, I think Heather Watson probably hasn't performed as well.
Heather Watson's been on a downwards trajectory for the last couple of years, which is a shame, because I think since she had a really great match against Serena Williams at Wimbledon, she nearly won that, which was such a great match to watch. She played fantastically well, and since then it's all gone a bit to pot, really.
Yeah, I think that game proved that she's got the talent.
Absolutely.
I mean, Serena Williams didn't play badly in that game, and yes, ultimately she came away with the win, but Heather Watson, I'm pretty sure she had match point in that game.
I think she might have been.
I remember watching it it was the first Friday of Wimbledon.
I think it was the third round,
baking
yeah.
hot day.
And it was Heather Watson really showed her technical nous there as well, using the slice, moving Williams around the court, exposing some of her weaknesses in her movement, and really demonstrating what a high quality player she is in her, and also her technical ability. And it's a shame that she hasn't been able to capitalise on that. Also, Johanna Konta's had a bit of patchy form this year, but has on the whole over the last year or two been very good for us. I think the thing is, once you get into that level as much higher profile, I think you can be spurred on. We've seen some incredible performances from James Ward, Dan Evans and Kyle Edmund in the Davis Cup, beating the likes of John Isner and Juan Martín Del Potro, who are fantastic players. And I think that really shows that anything can happen in the Fed Cup, and that hopefully we can get into the World Group next year and show the world of women's tennis what we're all about.
Yeah, exactly, Matt. I think, as you just said, we've definitely got the players. Joanna Konta, if she can continue to move up the rankings, if Heather Watson can rediscover some of this form, then anything is possible. And Rahul touched on a great point as well, which is this idea of a team environment. In sports like tennis, in sports like golf, it's very much an individual sport for a lot of the time, unless you're obviously playing doubles. And I'm going to use the golf analogy again. One of the biggest events in golf is the Ryder Cup.
Yeah.
The main reason the players enjoy it, the idea of being part of this winning team. And you don't get that very often in tennis. The Fed Cup, the Davis Cup, that's seemingly tennis players only your opportunity to have that. So yeah, I personally think we should definitely persist with it. I've got a question for Matt here, though. I wanted to test his tennis knowledge because I know it's very good, but
okay,
I was looking this up before we started the podcast. Who has won the Fed Cup in previous years? So who won it last year? Do you know?
Was it the Czech Republic?
That was a great shout. It was the United States last year, and then the Czech Republic won it the 3 years prior to that.
Yeah, I knew they were very good at it.
And five of the last 6 years. So, yeah, that's pretty outstanding. But this brings me... The main reason I asked you that is because that fittingly brings me on to my next question, which is, does the Fed Cup, does the Davis Cup demand a format change? Like, because at the minute, one of the main reasons the likes of the Czech Republic have been doing so well is because they've got outstanding players. Like, off the top of my head, Petra Kvitova, I think, is Czechoslovakian.
Yeah, she Kvitova has really led the Czech Republic there, and they've Svitolina as well has also been a good player for them. So I think they've just got the consistency across the board that can really grind out the results and get through. I think they've got a good doubles pairing as well, although their name eludes me.
Yeah, no, likewise, Matt. But at the same time, as we saw with GB's Davis Cup success, one person can single-handedly win you the tie. I mean, yes, Kyle Edmund got some valuable victories during that time, but a lot of the time, Andy Murray really pulled it out of the bag. He won two singles games and doubles games with his brother, I think, the vast majority of the time. So for me, because of this idea of it being a team sport, considering one person can single-handedly affect the tie so much, do you think this demands a format change?
I would say so. I think that it's a strange one, because obviously you want to make sure that it's recognised that some players who play for their countries are much better than others. But you need to make it a sort of a team sport. That's the idea of the Fed Cup or the Davis Cup. I think that you can make it sort of all inclusive, and they could look at that. I don't know perhaps how they would do it. Maybe they can make it three individuals. They could do something like you have to have four individual singles players, then one doubles match, and then you would potentially reduce the amount that your star player plays to two. That might be an idea.
Yeah, I mean, the single matches and double matches, they're very reliant on individuals, and the Davis Cup and the Fed Cup offer opportunity for a team sport and for a team environment to really thrive in. And I think if it does allow for individuals to really gain a foothold and to essentially win it for their country, completely contradicts the idea of having a team sport. And so, yeah, as Matt, as you said, if they try and find a way of making sure that each individual doesn't have... I know we should be aware that some players may be better than others, but if there is a way of formatting it so that each individuals don't gain an extra advantage for their country, then that would definitely help the team atmosphere and the team spirit.
Yeah, I mean, in my opinion, I think a good way of doing it would be every player is only allowed to play one game, and each player in the squad has a seeding. So Andy Murray would obviously be top seed for our Davis Cup team. He would play against the top seed for whichever respective country we were coming up against. So if we played Spain, it would be Andy Murray versus Rafael Nadal. And then our second seed, Kyle Edmund, would play against David Ferrer or whoever.
Carina Busta, perhaps, somewhere like that.
Yeah, Artista. I've completely messed up that name.
Pablo Carina Busta.
Batista Agu. There we go. Got that in the end. But yeah, I think that would be a good way of doing it. I think, like Rahul just said, that would stop these countries gaining an unnecessary competitive advantage, because we don't want to see Andy Murray coming up against the Spanish bottom seeds, because at the minute, a lot of these countries are playing it tactically. They like saving their players for doubles games or singles games. They sort of identify games they can win in that way, and I just don't think it's a very good way of doing it. And I think if we did it that way, we would see the best country winning the Davis Cup every year, because I think despite GB's achievement, however amazing it was, that we were not the best tennis nation that year, were we? And no. It should be the best tennis nation wins the Davis Cup the vast majority of the time. Isn't that the point of it, to discover who is the best tennis nation?
Yeah, I think that it's definitely, I think you're right there, Ron. I think it's sort of a collective thing rather than who's got the best player. But you need to look at the ATP or what WTA rankings to work that out. So I think that your seeding idea I really like, and I think it would make it more like a tournament to determine which the best country was. So yeah, I think that I really read that as an idea personally moving forwards.
Oh, thank you, Matt.
I'll try
and propose that one then, and hopefully the tennis governing body, the ATP. What's the tennis governing body called?
It's for men, it's the ATP Association of, ATP, of Tennis yeah. Professionals, and WTA is Women's yeah. Tennis Association. Women's
Association, yeah. So I'll pitch that idea to them, and fingers crossed, in a year's time, then I'll get the credit I deserve for
you
it. You're anyway.
Getting too big for us then, Ollie.
Revolutionising.
Oh, don't worry. I'd never leave strawberries and cream. Oh. I'll take it onto the bigger stage.
I'll know that down for future.
Yeah. But anyway, yeah, we'll move on from this. It was an interesting debate that, and yeah, hopefully we'll see some sort of change in the future. But we'll move on now to Maria Sharapova.
Yes.
Yeah, we've discussed her quite a lot. I think we discussed her on the previous podcast.
Quite a controversial figure, really. She's a
very controversial figure, yeah. So she's lost 4 matches in a row now. Her most recent loss came against Caroline Garcia in Germany. And this will mean that she will drop out of the top 50. So for want of a better way to phrase this, given all the controversy, like Matt mentioned, surrounding her drug use and the fact that she's been relatively irrelevant for some time now, do you actually care that she's dropped out of the top 50?
I think it's a bit sad, really, because I think the questions are raised that, you know, was she only ever as good as she was because of her use of banned substances? Mm. I think that's definitely something you have to raise, given her lack of form that's coming back. But most tennis players, you know, I don't know if you remember, I think Andy Murray had surgery in 2015, and for sort of the latter half of 2015 and first half of 2016, he was a bit ropey, he was struggling to come back. But he ended up being world number one at the end of, I think it was 2016 or 2017, showing that he was able to bounce back because he was good enough on his own. And I think the fact that Sharapova has been unable to do that shows that the questions are raised as to her performance-enhancing drugs use, and that, quite simply, you know, I think people have forgotten about her. I think she has become a bit irrelevant, as you said there, Ollie.
I mean, she's become a really controversial figure with her 15-month drug ban for drug offences. I mean, it is questioned again whether those who have been taking enhancing drugs should be allowed back in the sport, and it does raise questions about the morals amongst the sport, and whether it's an unfair advantage to those who she could have potentially played against, and having been on enhancing drugs and gained that little advantage that could have made her win the game instead of another opponent. So I mean. To be frank, do I care that she dropped out of the top 50? I mean, not really, because I've always had this negative view of people who've been using enhancing drugs. I know previously, I think it was for medical reasons, I believe.
Supposedly. Although the people who sort of said the way the drug worked was, basically, if you're a top-level athlete, you shouldn't be on melatonin for that long, and it's very dodgy. And it was a banned substance, so I think, you know, questions that will always be on Sharapova about her success in the past, whether it's true or not, which is a bit sad, really. You don't want to see anybody sort of succumbing to that, whether they've done it or not, to be honest.
The main thing for me, and the main reason why I don't really care, is because I think she's been irrelevant in women's tennis for a long time. I think you've touched on these banned substances and whether or not you can blame her for it, because it's a bit touch and go as to what we think of that. There's a lot of different opinions on whether she should have been allowed to use it or not. We don't really know if she was lying. But if she's been using it for a long time, she hasn't exactly been at the top of women's tennis for a while. She had a bit of success at the start of her career, but I don't think she's been that good recently.
She hasn't, no. She won the French Open a few years back, but she's really struggled, especially against Serena Williams, who she supposedly has a big rivalry with. But you know what? Really, she's not really had any success. I'm just trying to find the statistic, but I don't think she's beaten Serena Williams since about 2005, which is madness, really, when you think about how good a player Sharapova definitely sort of used to be. So I think that's really, really quite surprising. And I think it shows that you might be right there, Ollie, that she hasn't been able to basically be at that level for quite a while now, and I think that's a real shame.
I mean, she's probably been also quite known for her like ambassador role for the UN. I mean, the fact that that's being highlighted so often in terms of whether she's a role model emphasizes that her role is almost a lot focused upon outside the tennis game rather than inside. So the fact that a lot of people are talking about her ambassadorial role instead of her actual performances in tennis does emphasize that she is becoming a little bit irrelevant now.
Yeah, and I think we can move this now on then to the Women's French Open. Do we give Maria Sharapova any chance there, or given her recent bad run of form?
No.
No?
Okay. No, I well, didn't think so.
All right, that one's done then. Move.
No, to put a bit more into that, I think that the form says no. I think Simona Halep is the clear favourite for the French Open, given her form on clay court, her form generally. You know, obviously just missed out on her first Grand Slam at the Australian Open this year. So I think she really wants it, and I think she's really hungry for it, and I suspect she'll win it. I think Serena Williams... Maybe I could see her winning the US Open. I think she might be able to get back to form by that time. I don't think she'll be quite good enough to win Wimbledon yet. I don't think she'll win the French. So I think that, I don't think there's really a way. I don't think there's a place for Sharapova at the top of women's tennis anymore, to be honest, which is a bit of a sad thing to say. But, you know, that's the nature of sport, and I think that's moved on.
That being said, the women's game does tend to throw up a lot more surprises than the men's game, though, doesn't it? I think in terms of men's Grand Slams, you do tend to see the same sort of names figuring every time, whereas there's often a lot of wild cards who end up going quite far in many of these big women's Grand Slams.
I think that's really exciting to see, really. I think that really does liven up the women's game a bit, and I think it shows why it's such an exciting spectacle to watch, to be honest. And I think it shows, you know, last year, for instance, Yelena Ostapenko won the French Open, and nobody expected that. I was like, oh, blimey, who's she? I mean, obviously, she was known for being around the circuit, but she only ever got to 32 in the world, and that's just so surprising. But you know what? I think that's the great nature of sport, and especially women's tennis, that the fact that these people can come through, not from nowhere, but really surprise everyone. And I think that makes it so much more exciting to watch.
I actually think the women's tennis game has taken a massive lift since Serena Williams took a break, because it was getting to the stage. I did mention that we do see a lot more women figuring in the latter stages of these tournaments, but we did also see Serena Williams winning the vast majority of them. I mean, at one stage a year or so ago, or a couple of years ago, she was pretty unstoppable, wasn't she? So I think it was quite refreshing for the women's tennis game to see other names making a name for themselves. Simona Halep, Caroline Wozniacki came back to the top of the rankings, and we hadn't seen her figure for a long time. Yeah, so I think it was very refreshing to see, and like you said, I actually hope that Serena Williams doesn't win the French Open. So Rahul has just informed me that he's got a pretty crazy stat about the women's French Open, and sort of the fact that we're seeing a lot more women tennis players sort of making a name for themselves. We're seeing a lot more sort of inexperienced sort of people that you wouldn't expect to get this far. Going far in these major tournaments. So Rahul, take it away.
I mean, last year in the French Open, it was categorized that this was the French Open with the land of opportunity. I mean, it was the first time since 1977 the quarterfinal lineup was devoid of any players to win a major title, which is, I mean, there was players like Wozniacki who had made Grand Slam finals, but the very fact that there wasn't a single player who had won a major title in the quarterfinal lineup just evidences that it is such an open. I mean, I know Serena Williams wasn't participating in that, but it just shows how open women's tennis is in comparison to. I can't remember the last time in a Grand Slam quarterfinal there wasn't a single majors winner for men's. I mean, it seems irregular as such, but that just evidences how open women's tennis is and could potentially be in the future.
Yeah, that's an absolutely crazy statistic, and it really does exemplify the point that we've just made and how refreshing it is for women's tennis to see a lot of these women trying to make a name for themselves. But anyway, I think that pretty much sums up I'll chat on that, and we're going to finish this week by talking about probably everyone in Britain's favourite tennis player now, Andy Murray. Sort of, he has divided opinion over the years, hasn't he? But I think most people quite like him.
I really like him. I think he's a really nice man, and I think fundamentally, and also, he's a very good tennis player who's been very successful despite some of the people he's had to come up against. So I think I'm a big fan personally.
Yeah, so Andy Murray, he's still yet to make his comeback. He was meant to return at the Glasgow Trophy this week, but opted to continue his recovery process. So he's not actually scheduled to play again now until May, which is just a couple of tournaments before Wimbledon gets underway. Is this worrying?
I think it is a little bit, but you know what? I think, I don't want to be negative. I'm being a bit negative about Djokovic earlier. I think this could be getting towards the twilight years of Murray's career because of his injuries. But I think we just celebrate him for the success he's had. My favourite sporting memory of my lifetime that I remember is him winning Wimbledon. I just remember that feeling because every match I went in the country was watching that. That was, I think, probably the greatest British sport moments of the 21st century so far. You know, 20 million people watched that. That's a ridiculous stat to think about. And I think we should just celebrate him for the phenomenal player that he is and has been.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. I mean, whether he can... I mean, he's still got an option to play a challenger event in Loughborough, I think, next month. So whether that enables him to gain some sort of momentum towards Wimbledon is potential. But I mean, I'm hoping we haven't seen the best of Murray, and I'm hoping there's still more to come. But with these injuries, you just never know how it's going to affect a tennis player and how it's going to affect his shots and his movements. And I think over the next 1 or 2 years, we'll realise whether that was the best or whether there's still more to come.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with what you two are saying. It's obviously a real shame to see Murray suffering with these injuries at the minute. It's a shame to see a lot of these big players suffering with injuries. Murray, Djokovic, I think Vavrinka's been injured or suffering from injuries for a while
now.
Yeah,
he's been struggling. I think it's time for the next gen to come through, really.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. But like I think Matt said as well, I think Andy Murray, you've got to put him down as one of the greatest British sportsmen of all time, regardless of whether he carries on playing tennis. I mean, that Wimbledon achievement was absolutely outstanding. And what made it even better was the fact that he'd come so close yet so far so many times. I think he'd lost his first six Grand Slam finals
It was the first six he lost, yeah.
And he'd lost against Federer the previous year or the year before that, I think, and he'd won the first set against Federer. It looked absolutely unbelievable, and Federer, as he'd done so many times, came out of nowhere and stormed the next three sets up, and Murray was heartbroken. I remember him crying in his post-match press conference afterwards, which was really tough to take.
It was emotional, wasn't it? You could see how much it meant him and how much pressure he's under, and you just had to feel sorry for him, really.
And yeah, that final against Djokovic was one of the best tennis games I've ever seen, because Djokovic did not play badly, and Murray took it in straight sets, and it was absolutely unbelievable. And he's won Sports Personality more times than anyone else, I think, as well. So I think that goes to show how highly regarded he is now. But anyway, yeah, I think are we in unanimous agreement in that? Should Andy Murray be celebrated as one of Britain's great sportsmen, regardless of whether he wins another Grand Slam?
I don't know about what Rahul thinks of this, but I think so. I think the reason I look at his achievements in tennis so highly is because I look at the level men's tennis has been at for the last few years and the players he had to play against and the success he's had and the way he's done it. I think he is up there with the likes of people like Mo Farah, Roger Bannister, Jeff Ennis, and those sort of great figureheads, really. And I really think he's a great role model as well. I think he's encouraged a lot of people to get into tennis. The reason I started playing tennis was after he won the Olympic gold. You know, I thought, oh, I think it's really fun, and I started playing, and I sort of fell in love with tennis ever since, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, he's definitely up there in terms of being a role model, and he has won the Grand Slams, and every tournament, Britain basically has Murray in their hearts and cheer him on to the end. But I mean, to put him up in that bracket, it's just I think it was unfortunate that he was in that period of the big players and he wasn't able to be as successful. But to see his response to these injuries will be a real testament to see what kind of player and what kind of mentality he has. So I think in the next 1 or 2 years we'll see what kind of player he is.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I think obviously Murray's taken some time out as well to focus on bringing through the younger generation. He started his own company now, I think, which is aiming to sort of bring sort of disadvantaged kids who have sporting talent up through the ranks and sort of give them the development which he claimed that he didn't have. I think Murray often goes on about how his development probably could have been better.
I think the thing was he had to go to Spain to basically become the tennis player that he is and move away from home at 15, which is a hard thing to do And if you do have to feel sorry for him, I think it's good that he wants to make change in British tennis like this and hopefully makes a better tennis nation for the future. So I really respect Andy Murray a lot for that.
Yeah, no, again, man, I completely agree with you. I've said that a lot on this show, but yeah, I think we've pretty much been in unanimous agreement on most things other than the fact that I think the French Open is fairly boring. But anyway, that pretty much brings us to the end of this podcast. One thing that I would want to say just before we finish is that it's the start of our varsity series at the minute, and Rahul is actually going to be taking the tennis coverage next week. So Rahul, do you want to give the listeners just sort of a brief oversight of what we're going to expect from varsity tennis? Perhaps are the University of Nottingham going to be favourites going into the game?
I mean, it's going to be a really exciting thing to watch and commentate on, but yeah, Nottingham, University of Nottingham definitely do seem to be having the advantage against Nottingham Trent. I mean, Nottingham first men's are currently third in the North Division, having played 10 games and won 7. And Nottingham Trent team are in the same league as Nottingham Force team. And with them both drawing a game and Nottingham Uni winning the other game, there's definitely evidence that Nottingham first men's team should definitely unanimously win this varsity tennis match.
Yeah, well, that's very good to hear, and fingers crossed that the University of Nottingham can get a win next week. They've started the varsity series very well. I think Matt was covering the Super Wednesday yesterday.
Absolutely.
And that went phenomenally well, didn't it? I think it was a whitewash.
It was a whitewash. We won the 12th and 11th rule to say it was to make 1-0 in the series after we forfeited the men's football. For the varsity coverage, just tune in to From the Gantry every Tuesday and Thursday for the next couple of weeks, 6 till 7. Also catch Varsity Tonight, our comedy show, and follow us on social media at URN Sport and on Facebook as URN Sport to keep up to date with everything.
Yep, as Matt said, follow us at URN Sport. And if you have a question about anything that we've discussed on the podcast today, or an opinion about any of the stuff we've discussed, do you also think that the French Open is the worst Grand Slam? Is Andy Murray going to make a return to tennis? Can anyone beat Rafael Nadal? Then please get in touch with us. But anyway, thanks for listening to Strawberries and Cream. Catch us again soon.
This is URN, the sports show.